WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, the Senate Armed Services Committee opened hearings on homosexuals in the military. President Clinton supports lifting the military ban on gays and lesbians. He asked the Pentagon to submit its policy recommendations by July 15th. In the interim, gays are still prohibited from serving, but recruits are no longer being asked about their sexual orientation. What is the history of gays and the military? We invited Alan Berube to join us. He's the author of the book Coming Out Under Fire, A History of Gays and Lesbians in World War II. He started his research in the late 70s. His early research was sponsored by the San Francisco Lesbian and Gay History Project. The military's policy of screening out gays and lesbians dates back to the early 1940s.
The screening started in 1941 amid much controversy. And what it did for the first time was, under a draft, to ask potential inductees if they were homosexual. And on that basis, if they were to say yes, then they would be excluded from military service. Right away, it created a problem, which was that men who were heterosexual began to say they were homosexual to avoid the draft. And two, gay men began to be able to avoid military service by saying they were homosexual.
What was the reason for instituting the ban on gays?
The ban or the screening? The ban really has two parts. It's screening and discharge. The screening part was, it was brought in kind of on the backs of the psychiatrists. They were beginning to be involved in the military institution, really for the first time in World War II in any significant way. And their argument was that if we screen recruits for psychiatric problems, even those who aren't insane, that was the old arguments that people were either insane or sane, they were saying that they were personality disorders, too, that would might lead people to break down in combat. If we can identify them at the entry level, then we can avoid psychiatric casualties in the military. That was a promise they couldn't keep. They realized by the middle of the war that you can't screen out people who are going to not do well in military service. But they were trying to do that. And in that was the category of a constitutional psychopathic state, subcategory sexual psychopath, subcategory homosexual. And that's how the screening for homosexuality began, as a subcategory of psychopath.
So homosexuals were considered psychopaths, and the fear was that they wouldn't perform well under the pressure of war?
Right. Screening was based on three reasons. One is that homosexuals were considered to be unfit because gay men, queers as they were called, were effeminate. It was based on a stereotype that all queers were fairies and therefore would not make good soldiers, a wrong stereotype. The second was that they were mentally ill, they were emotionally unstable like women, and since women couldn't perform in military, then gay men couldn't perform. And third is that they would be teased and abused by the other men when they found out that they were fairies, and that they would break under that pressure, not necessarily combat, but under being teased, and the sexual attraction might disrupt morale. Those were the initial three reasons. So, the security risk reason wasn't introduced until the Cold War, and it was rejected, in fact, during World War II as a legitimate argument against gays serving.
The regulation that screened out gays was instituted before World War II. Did that change when the war started?
Yes. In fact, under the pressure of war, when there was an increasing manpower and, by the middle of the war, woman power shortage, the screening standards became more and more lax, so that, in fact, for women in the Women's Army Corps, they were not specifically screened for homosexuality, for lesbianism, until very late in the war when the recruiting was over. And in many, many induction stations, men were knowingly taken in as gay. The induction examiners were wise to the fact that many men were trying to avoid military service by saying they were gay, so they just wouldn't believe them. What's interesting about the current debate in relation to World War II is that the main focus in World War II was the duty of the citizen to serve his country. And now the focus, the debate is about whether military service is a right or a privilege.
So the military was more open to accepting homosexuals during the height of the war. Is that what you're saying?
Not officially, but in practice, yes. During the pressure, the manpower needs, the shortages of wartime, they were much more kind of practical and even cynical about keeping homosexuals in until the war was over.
Have there been periods in which the military has been particularly vigilant in trying to ferret out homosexuals who have passed and have gotten in?
Absolutely. And one of the problems that the policy creates, this is important, this is what the policy creates, is a climate of fear, rumor spreading, and witch hunting, as it was called as early as World War II, where someone could turn in the name of someone and saying they're a homosexual, and then investigations would start. These would erupt and still erupt all over the place. They are one of the, in a way, uncontrollable consequences of the policy. They lead to people submitting lists of names, people being interrogated, psychologically abused, and even physically tortured for hours and hours, sometimes days without end, until they provide names of people they know to be gay or sign a confession that they have committed sexual acts. That leads to a whole other set of names. People get called in. The history is one of locking up groups of people in what were called queer stockades, queer brigs, parading them and displaying them in public for public humiliation by marching them in segregated units in front of the other troops so they would be jeered at and catcalled, eating separately in mess halls, even putting in barbed wire pens with signs that say queer stockades. Then they were sent home and forced to turn themselves in at their draft boards where their hometown, they would basically be outed in their hometowns. The whole process of discharge under those circumstances, and when there are roundups or purges or witch hunts, is a shameful history in our country. It has involved tens of thousands of people. It has, for the most part, been secret. It is a history of abuse and violence and cruelty. It involves suicides and even murders in some cases. And there's an illusion being created that this policy is merely a bureaucratic procedure. It just has to do with legalistic procedures, and that no people are affected by it. But the history is something completely different than that.
My guest is Alan Berube, author of the book Coming Out Under Fire, A History of Gays and Lesbians in World War II. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alan Berube. One of the arguments being used now against admitting gays to the military is that it could be a threat to discipline and morale.
That's right.
Is that a new argument?
No, that's not a new argument. That was the third argument that I'd mentioned from World War II. The other two, the effeminacy and the mental illness arguments, have been dismissed. But the third one still exists. And in a way, that is at the core of the policy. It kind of has two parts. One has to do with prejudice, and one has to do with sexuality. But that is the core argument, I think, against for the exclusion of homosexuals in the armed forces.
Can you expand the argument for us and explain the premise of it?
The morale and discipline argument. Actually, one thing that's important is that the phrase morale and discipline is a buzzword, and it covers up a whole conglomeration of prejudices, fears, sexual tensions, hatreds, disgust, urges to kill. I mean, there's an ugly core there. But the buzzword is morale and discipline. Two parts of it have to do with prejudice and with sex. The prejudice part is similar to the arguments against African Americans, for example. Then it was white men just will not serve with Negroes, as the language was in the 40s. Now it's that heterosexual men just will not serve with homosexual men or men they know to be homosexual. So that part of the argument is that prejudice, basically the assumptions are that prejudice exists. It will not change. It cannot change. And the unstated assumption is, from the military officials, we don't want it to change. Therefore, heterosexual men cannot trust, will not serve with, nor will they take orders from anyone they know to be homosexual. That's the prejudice part of the argument. The sex part of the argument is that sexual tensions exist within same-sex situations. The shower, this is the famous shower argument, the barracks, closely knit combat units. Sexual tensions exist there because homosexuals exist there. If we get rid of the homosexuals, we will get rid of the sexual tensions.
Well, is there anything historically that argues one side or the other side of this story? For instance, if gays for the first time in recent history were allowed to be in the military and be out,
right?
It would be the first time that men in their troops knew that they were gay, or that women around them knew that they were a lesbian. And there would perhaps be a certain sexual tension in the air that hadn't been there before, and a certain discomfort for straight men in the showers or in the barracks.
Right. Well, let's take this up. There's two parts there. Let's take those apart. The first is this would be the first time that anyone who was heterosexual knew they were serving with someone who was bisexual or gay or lesbian. That's false, because one of the things that's interesting is how many gay men, for example, and lesbians remember in World War II that they were serving with people who knew they were gay. And what's happened recently on many radio talk shows, for example, is that heterosexual veterans are calling in and say, I knew that I served with so-and-so. It wasn't a problem. They didn't bother me. I didn't bother them.
You could argue, though, that the people who gays and lesbians came out to in the military were the people who were most open-minded about it, not to the people who were most homophobic.
Right, and there's really no reason for that to change. I mean, there's no reason for that to change if the ban were lifted.
In other words, people wouldn't have to be very out. They wouldn't have to proclaim who they were, and it wouldn't have to be an issue unless they wanted to make it one. Is that what you're saying?
Right. Or, I mean, there's another stereotype being constructed here during this debate, which is very interesting, is that the only way anybody knows that someone is gay is when they go to other people and say, I am a homosexual. Well, that could happen, and that happens once in a while. But in fact, there's other ways of people knowing. They see them going to a gay bar. Rumors spread. It's extraordinary how many people who are heterosexual kind of know who is gay around them. When it's on that level, which is going to be still the common level if the ban is lifted, it's not the same as a deliberate coming out, kind of in-your-face coming out statement.
What do you make of the argument that if gays were legally allowed in the military, that there'd be a lot of tension in the showers?
This shower argument is very interesting to me. It has become kind of the symbolic core of this whole debate. And it's about sex. It's about desire, not sex. It's about desire and about knowing. The argument is that heterosexual men, since they have to strip down with other men in shower rooms, have a right not to knowingly be in the presence of someone who is homosexual and who might look at their naked bodies with sexual desire. That's when they use the term right to privacy, that's what it's about. It's the right not to be looked at. Two things very interesting about this is that, first of all, there's a kind of female impersonation going on here, that heterosexual men are presenting themselves as women who are feminized, the sexual objects of the men who are the gay men who are looking at them with desire. That's interesting because I don't know of any other place in American society where heterosexual men are saying that they are just like women, and that they need the protection of the government from the men who are the gay men. I think the underlying situation here is there's a core contradiction. The military creates environments that where men look at each other men's bodies, just men look at each other men's bodies, are in close quarters with each other, and it kind of incites an eroticism, no matter who people are, attention, jealousies, romance, buddies, love, a desire to look at each other. That's and the procedures for stripping men down, the physical and induction physical examinations, for example, are classic, where men are walking around naked, being looked at very, very, very closely in all their body parts by other men. That's okay as long as looking allegedly is not done with sexual desire. The irony is, or the difficulty is, that the eroticism of those situations cannot, the military creates those situations. Homosexuals, in fact, are very good at controlling themselves in those situations. We have a lot of practice doing that. And so that the removal of homosexuals, all that does is it creates the illusion that there's no eroticism there because allegedly there are only heterosexuals left. So what you do is allow heterosexuals to believe that only heterosexuals are there by making sure that they don't know that there are any homosexuals there.
In your book, you quote a couple of studies conducted by the military and the Defense Department about the ability of gays to serve well in the military.
Right.
What did those studies find?
The studies began within months of when the policy was put into effect, the discharge policy in 1943. The first one was issued in 45. They remarkably come to very similar conclusions. One is that homosexual soldiers, considering their performance, lesbian and gay soldiers perform no better and no worse than other personnel. Second is that there is no evidence for them being a security risk. Third is that they do not constitute a class of people, and the military has no evidence for saying they constitute a class of people. And fourth, that their performance should be judged on their individual merit and not as members of a class. Almost consistently, most of these reports that have been generated from within the armed forces all the way to up to a couple of years ago have been suppressed by the Army and the Navy and not been allowed to be released. Whenever the military has conducted its internal reports and they have come to these conclusions, it has suppressed these reports and kept them from being made public.
One of the reports that you quoted, a 1957 Navy report that concluded there was no evidence to support the idea that homosexuals as a class cannot acceptably serve in the military or that there were security risks, that 1957 study was released in 1977. So that's been out for a while.
It has been out for a while, and it was released because a judge ordered it to be the Navy to release it. They had first claimed that it didn't exist. When the judge in Chicago, I think, in a discharge trial, appeal trial, subpoenaed the report, then the Navy made it public.
Now, that 1957 report recommended no change in military policy on homosexuality because that report suggested that the military shouldn't move ahead of civilian society in its acceptance of homosexuality.
That's right, and that really echoes with what the many military officials and senators, for example, government officials are saying, that the military is not an engine of social change and should not be, and should not lead. It should follow the rest of society. In terms of the political climate, social climate in 1957, it would have been an innovation at that point to have a non-discrimination or to lift the ban in the armed forces. Right now, the U.S. military is one of the few major agencies in the country that still has such an explicit and such a vehemently anti-gay policy. So it is way behind the rest of much of society. Society has changed considerably since 1957.
Your book, Coming Out Under Fire, explores a certain paradox, which is that although gays have been officially unwelcome in the military, many gays have served in the military, and in fact, World War II helped to create the gay subculture in America.
Right, right. There is a continuing irony here, which is that the military unintentionally, and certainly probably doesn't want to be doing this, but what it does is, in fact, especially when there's a draft, take people from small towns and rural areas, collects them into military bases, which are often stationed, located near major metropolitan areas. It is one of the most efficient ways of introducing young men and women to the gay life in the cities. It also created by targeting homosexuals and by defining them really for the first time in World War II as a class of people who are targeted for systematic discrimination, it gave gay men and lesbians and bisexuals their first cause, which was to fight for the right to serve in the military. So in a way, it defined homosexuals as a class of American citizens, and then politicized that class by systematically discriminating against them. So that in a way, it helped to shape a gay movement.
What do you see now as being the alternatives that the Senate Committee on the Armed Services might come up with now?
I have no idea. I think the Senate Committee, Armed Services Committee, really with Senator Nunn as their chair, is mostly interested in figuring out ways to keep the ban in place, maybe making minor alterations, but using the hearings as a way of establishing the proponents of the ban as the rational, objective middle in this debate, and establishing anyone for lifting the ban as to be an extremist on one side, and anyone who is vehemently anti-gay as the extremists on the other side. So that keeping the status quo with minor modifications, like not asking people as they enter, for example, it looks like their interest is in using the hearings to do that.
How important do you think the ban on gays in the military is in the gay community?
It is very important. And the reason is not so much because the military is such an important institution for many, many people, because for many it's not, although it is critically important for those who are lower middle class, working class, and poor, it being one of the few places that you can get work and training these days. But why it's very important is the same reason why military service has been important for African Americans, for women, for Japanese Americans who were in the internment camps, and other people who had been excluded from the mainstream of public life. And that is, military service, especially the right to serve in combat, whether we like it or not, has traditionally been the justification and the way of earning legitimation and full citizenship in the United States. So this has become a battle over citizenship, over full citizenship. Who is going to be entitled, which Americans are going to be entitled to become and remain full citizens in the United States? So it's highly symbolic. It is the battle over that issue of citizenship.
Ellen Berube, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you, Terry.
Ellen Berube is the author of the book Coming Out Under Fire, A History of Gays and Lesbians in World War II. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.